Get in the game at Vons. We're kicking off the football season with big prizes. Look for the Game On participating player tags, buy any three, and enter your code for a chance to win. Use your club card at Vons and get Gatorade 32 ounces selected varieties 10 for $10. And Life or Captain Crunch cereal selected sizes and varieties 2 for $6. No purchase necessary. Open to residents of Southern California counties listed in rules 18 years and older. Ends January 9, 2018. Enter code by January 12, 2018. Rules at GameOnSoCal.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn. You tell me. You come home. Je come home back. Je ne comprends rien de ça.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is Kinsey Institute researcher and evolutionary biologist Dr. Justin Garcia. He's co-author with Dr. Peter B. Gray of this encyclopedic new book, Evolution and Human Sexual Behavior. He's done a slew of fascinating studies on sex, and he will debunk a whole bunch of myths about sex with the latest research about who's doing what to whom, how things have changed, and how we can do each other better. So tonight we're going to talk about orgasms, fantasies, hooking up, what's changed about oral sex, how people can make internet dating work better for them, how the proliferation of porn really affects the average person's sex life, and whether you can get better in bed and how. So stick with us, because basically tonight's show will help you make the latest science on sex your bitch. So hello, Justin.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me on.
I had to get dirty at the end. You're welcome. So let's start. I mean, what better place to start than with a happy ending? So let's start with orgasms. Let's talk about where people go wrong in thinking about orgasms.
There's a few misconceptions about orgasm in humans, and they range from exactly what it is. So let's start maybe with a definition. And the way that we define orgasm in a research setting is a sort of a complicated, but it's also very subjective. On the one hand, there's changes in the brain. There's a hormonal change. There's the way that the whole body responds. There's rhythmic patterns in the genitals. So it can be a really complicated physiological process. But because of that, it also changes the way that we sort of think about what it is. And this goes back to a lot of us might think about Freud and how Freud described different types of orgasm to contemporary researchers who write about deep orgasm versus surface orgasm versus vaginal orgasms, clitoral orgasms. So thinking about really what is it, much more complicated in women. And men, we know that orgasm is a spinal reflex, so it actually doesn't involve the brain all that much. not surprisingly. And in women, orgasm is really interesting because it's subject, at least our data and the data of many others are suggesting, that women's orgasm is subject to so many different things. And what I mean by that is like attitudes and comfort level, the psychological state of a person can impact their ability to achieve orgasm and how much they enjoy it.
I was just going to interject about casual sex, that there is that research that says that women are far less likely to have an orgasm from casual sex than if they're in a relationship.
Exactly, and there's a few reasons for that. We found that as well in some of our data with on students who are college students who hook up and whether they orgasm in a relationship or a sexual hookup. And part of it is for many of us, the first time, or many people, I should say, the first time one has sex with someone, it can be awkward. Not necessarily because it's bad, but you're getting used to learning a new body, a new person. One of the interesting things about genitals in humans is that there's so much variation. There's so much variation in the shape and texture and size and penises and vulvas and vaginas. And what that means is that with every new partner you're with, you have to sort of, it's like driving a new car. You sort of have to figure out where all the buttons are.
I love that description. That's really great. Now, per one of your studies, we talked on the phone earlier this week, and you said, you know, that you hear sex therapists say that partner communication is really important to having an orgasm. Like, I like when you touch me here, do this, do that, you know, kind of like that active listening. Is that true or not?
Well, it depends. Actually, we have no real good data on whether or not that's good advice. It's very common advice for couples, particularly in couples where one partner is having some sort of quote-unquote orgasmic dysfunction. And the reason I sort of am doing scare quotes here when I say it is because as an evolutionary biologist, I'm really careful about diagnosing variation as something of a dysfunction. So, yes, it's very common advice to tell people, well, you just need to talk to each other more and say, oh, okay, I like it when you touch me like this. And, well, there's probably actually a subset of couples that if they go home and start talking like that in the bedroom, it would probably cause them to break up. So it really depends. For some people, that might be good advice. But for others, it's probably quite bad advice. We just don't know. There isn't really good data. There haven't been good studies that look at how partner communication impacts orgasm and sexual satisfaction, and both in the positive and in the negative.
I was going to say, that's so interesting what you say, that it might ruin people's relationships. Some people do have this, you know, they prefer things remain unspoken, and a lot of people get embarrassed by that. But for somebody who doesn't, someone once told me a good way to direct someone is like they do it in the movies, where they don't give you a line reading, but they say just little things like harder, softer, slower, faster, more to the right. You know, so that does help some people quell the embarrassment of talking about sex, which many people feel, of course.
Yeah, and embarrassment comes in a variety of ways. One is the sexual ego. We all have, both of us have a sexual ego. And it can be damaged with not too much work. But part of it is also it's not necessarily just about one's own reputation and one's own ego. There's good evidence that suggests that, and this depends a lot on individual personalities and individual attachment styles, actually. So we know that we all have different attachment styles, and people, for instance, with an avoidant attachment style, they tend to view sex as really a temperature gauge of their relationship. And if the sex is bad, they go, oh, gosh, there's problems in our relationship. And if the sex is great, they go, oh, this is the love of my life. So it really has a lot to do with individual differences and attachment and personality and the way we view the world on the meaning that we give some of those encounters. But for some people, that short advice that your friend suggested, it's probably really good because it doesn't interject then a commentary about, well, do it this way. You know, I really like it this way. I told you I prefer it that way. If you put your tongue there and I want your hand right here on my hip, well, that's a very complicated instruction, particularly when you're in the middle of sexual life.
It's very bossy. It's very bossy sounding, too, and it's sort of like just a little interjection, like slower, faster, you know, harder. That it's just so much less embarrassing, I think.
And that's it. And people, exactly, it's a lot about embarrassment, and there's good data to suggest that people do get embarrassed. And it's not for a variety of things. You know, everyone, there's a phenomenon that we call pluralistic ignorance, the psychologists call pluralistic ignorance. And that's when you think that everyone else out in the world has got it better. It's what's most studied by alcohol researchers, because most people think other people can tolerate alcohol better, they drink more than they do, they enjoy partying more than they do. Well, there's something similar that happens in the bedroom and in our sexual lives. Most people think that everyone else has a better sex life, has a bigger penis, a nicer-looking vulva and vagina, tastes better, enjoys sex more, and we have all these perceptions of the norm. Well, in fact, we just all have these fantasies of what the norm are. But by definition, most of us are fairly close to the norm. So we try to compete with this reality that's not really there. So sometimes real simple instruction, simple discussion, but we need to be, America needs to be a place that we're willing to openly talk about sexuality and its role in our relationships. I mean, the best data suggests that low sexual satisfaction is the best predictor of divorce. Of all the different models that have run, sexual dissatisfaction is the best predictor of divorce. That's really saying something. We've got to really take sexuality and sexual behavior seriously in America.
Yeah, it's very important. And actually, I had an idea when we talked about this earlier that people can talk about their sexual problems in the dark because there's something, we're such simple creatures as humans that if you're just, if the person can't see you, you know, it's sort of like it's not happening in some way. And so that's something I would suggest for people having sexual problems. You know, be in a pitch black bedroom, you know, pull your shades, take the windows over, and then talk about sex. And you might feel a little less angst and embarrassment than if you talk about it, you know, at noon.
Yeah. I thought you were going to bring up blindfolds, Amy, but
also a good idea. But people don't have fun. You know, it's like you don't have to do, you know, I was going to bring up too, and I will at some point. This is the year of the diaper. I don't know what it is. And I'm not talking about, you know, like adult diapers because people dribble. I'm talking adult diapers because people have a fetish. We've got men in Huggies. I mean, it's crazy. And so, but, you know, and that's a little weird. And, you know, and there's some things like you better make sure that your partner's into, but people don't think they have enough fun to mix it up a little bit. You know, you don't have to get really weird and bring in raccoons or anything. And wear a blindfold. Pretend you're having an affair and go to a motel. Those things really can, you know, changing it up. As Sonia Lubomirsky says about happiness, she doesn't really talk too much about blindfolds and raccoons, but that this variety and surprise is really important. So if you every week planned a sex date and you did something each, you took turns with your partner or partners, if you're in some kind of open relationship, you know, and a different person planned it every week, then that's going to add fun to your relationship and keep it alive, you know, when you're with the same partner week after week, especially.
Yeah, I think there's good evidence in the literature, in the academic literature, that sexual variety is really important for a lot of people. And sometimes when couples aren't getting that, I do think that that's one of the factors that contributes to some people straying and committing infidelity. And it's a desire for something different. And exactly as you're saying, that doesn't have to mean that it's something that's beyond the comfort levels for some people. It could be in a different room or wearing, you know, a different position. A lot of couples can find that really a fulfilling way to enhance their romantic and sexual relationships. And I say romantic and sexual because for many couples, I see sex as intertwined with the romantic aspects of the relationship. It doesn't sit alone. It's not like we have love relationships and then sex happens separately. Sex is really involved in our relationships. It plays a huge part in regulating relationships.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Kinsey Institute researcher and evolutionary biologist Dr. Justin Garcia. He's co-author with Dr. Peter B. Gray of the encyclopedic new book, Evolution and Human Sexual Behavior. So I want to talk about lesbians. Lesbians and orgasms. So in 1966, I chuckle at every line of the show. In 1966, Masters and Johnson said heterosexuals could learn something from lesbians. And some of your data looks at orgasm rates, hetero men, gay men, and lesbians. And it turns out lesbian women orgasm more than straight women.
Yeah, this is a blast of a study. This is some new data we've got using a nationally representative data set of singles, mostly of U.S. singles. And what was interesting is among the men, heterosexual men and homosexual men, we didn't really see differences in rates of orgasm. Now, among the women, though, the lesbian women in our sample were orgasming at fairly higher rates than heterosexual women and less variation. Now, it raises all sorts of interesting questions.
Wait, can I stop you? Can I stop you? What do you mean by less variation?
The way we would do it statistically is we sort of look at, so imagine you have a few thousand people and you put them on a chart from 0 to 100 and where all the little individuals lie. Most women, the variation went all, in heterosexual women, the variation went from 100 to 0, it was all over the place. And homosexual women, it was clustered more towards the higher end. So more women were reporting orgasms. More lesbian women were reporting orgasms 90% of the time, 80% of the time.
Okay.
So there were slightly less who were saying 0%, 10%, 20%. So the numbers were clustering at higher percentages that they're achieving orgasms in their partner's sexual activities. This isn't masturbation, not solo sex, but having sex with a partner.
Now,
and there's a few reasons. One might be the obvious reason, right? It's a woman in another one female body in another female body. But Mathis and Johnson and that their 66 landmark piece, they also suggested, and what they suggested that heterosexuals could learn from lesbians was when having sex, focus a little bit more on your partner and yourself and the sexual activity and the pleasure and the couple, and focus more on that, and focus a little bit less on the performance aspect, on the show aspect. So really, it changes. I mean, for most of us, the sex is both a part of a relationship and a pleasurable activity, but it's also a bit of a show. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Sometimes people go, well, you know, my sex isn't a show. Well, of course, it's always a show. It's a performance. And it doesn't mean you have to get up and take a bow afterwards, but it's a performance. You could do a great job. But understanding that and understanding the role of performance in our sex lives and also when to perhaps dial that back a little bit and focus more on your partner, on seeing their body language, hearing what they need. And exactly as you were saying before, sometimes what they need is saying harder, faster. But sometimes it's nonverbal language. It's the body language. And that's the beauty of long-term relationships often, or continual sex with one partner. You often get to learn how each other's bodies work and communicate without language.
Well, I can't believe I'm bringing this up, but there's some book I have on my shelf somewhere that I've never really read. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I skimmed it. But, you know, this thing of trying to look at your partner anew, I think, is a very good idea. And then you and I have both heard people present research at conferences. I can't remember who, Miriam Fisher maybe, but about how women look at sex. They have more of a story to it. Women picture being ravished by men. Those romance novels, that it really is how women see sex. And men have a more porno look at it, where they see body parts and like, am I, you know, is this pumping right and everything. And so if men can understand and women can understand how the opposite sex sees sex, I think that's very helpful in trying to see that the person has a good time with you.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, one of the great things I loved about Alfred Kinsey when he really sort of pioneered sexology in America was that the focus on, we're not the judges of the behaviors we report. We're reporters of behaviors as sex researchers, and also that a focus on, there's a heck of a lot of variation out there in the world, but we need to understand it, and by understanding it, we can also make it have a better place in all of our lives. And that includes understanding, if you're a heterosexual male, what the ways that females think about sex and the way that they communicate sexual interest. So it's also specific to groups. If you're heterosexual, if you're homosexual, if you're bisexual, understanding information about who we are as sexual beings and who our partners are can really give us much more fulfilling lives, I think.
Yeah, I think it's important, as you said before, to not overestimate how great we have to be, and I think that's very important. And I had one more area I wanted to talk about with orgasms, and it's women faking it. And you said the other day that there's some evidence that women do this because they want to rush the event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's some really interesting studies that have come out on faking orgasm. Men do it on occasion, too. Often people can't imagine, at least we can think about it, and why would a guy fake an orgasm? Well, the common assumption is that orgasm in men happens when men ejaculate. But that happens most of the time, but there are actually two different responses that are sort of co-opted to occur together and physiologically. But there are many men who sometimes will ejaculate, and they really don't feel all that much. They don't have an orgasm, per se. And there are men who can have an orgasm without having the ejaculation happen. So similar in women, you can have sex and sometimes not. But for women, that's the faking the orgasm. I think there are a couple of things you and I were talking about that are interesting. One is I worry a little bit how many people out there, particularly among young heterosexuals, like college students who a lot of my work is with, might be engaging in sex, and they think that when they're, you know, female partner says, oh, Johnny, and bangs the wall, that she's in the throes of passion. Well, Well, not necessarily. She could be putting on a show, or he could be putting on a show. So really understanding, and actually the physiology of orgasm is pretty complex, not that easy to detect if you want to put on your, you know, white lab coat and be there like Masters and Johnson were, watching people as they were aroused. And so in that study, and some of those studies on faking orgasm, yes, some of it actually was because women were faking it because they wanted to try and get their male partners more aroused and ejaculate and reach orgasm, sometimes because they were feeling pain and discomfort. So sometimes the, you know, screaming, "Oh, Johnny," is just because, can we finish this up already? And sometimes it is the throes of passion. So it gets really complicated on what those vocalizations mean.
Oh, just on this pain thing, I read something interesting this week that a coconut oil can be used for lube, and that to me seems a lot less gross than all those weird flavored oils. So I think you should try that. Get, you know, Nutiva organic coconut oil at the health food store. You know, it can good for your hair, good for your skin, good for your sex. So
this is organic sex product.
Yeah, I like that. And then I wanted to say, too, about women, you know, the sound of an orgasm. We always picture it the way it is in the movies. I think that people, that's the bar that people, a lot of women try to hit, because they think, okay, in Harry Met Sally in the deli, that's how it's supposed to sound. But I actually had this long talk in a bar with this lesbian woman I know, and she said, oh, it was like the all orgasms are like snowflakes, you know. I mean, maybe there's not that much variation, but that she said some women moan softly, some women say nothing, some women just breathe really hard, some women scream and bang the headboard. And so I think that we need to have a different standard and understand that, you know, you don't have to be like Harry and Sally in the deli. You know, you could be really having a nice time.
Exactly. And there really is so much variation. And just like there's so much variation in what turns us on and what turns us off, there's variation in how we respond biologically, physiologically, psychologically to sexual activity. So at the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, where I work, we have a gallery, an art collection. And in that collection, there's a series of photos of people right at the moment that they're having an orgasm, both men and women. And my colleague Eric Janssen, who's in the office next to me, who Amy met via Skype quickly, Eric is one of the world's leading authorities on arousal, and he and I keep joking, I really want to do a study one day when we've got time, and show people these pictures of all these men and women who are, you know, these photos that were taken that are in our gallery collection of men and women as they're having an orgasm. And, you know, I'm a sex researcher, and I look at some of these faces, and I, you know, well, is that person crying? Is that person in pain? Is this person laughing? And maybe they are. And some of us know that there are some people who laugh, and then there are some who cry when they orgasm. Sometimes it's accompanied by an emotional response. But you look at these photos, and you just go, wow, is this a response that has a lot of variation? So I think your friend's snowflake comment is right. We one day we'll do this study. One day we'll get people to guess what these people in these photos are doing, and see how many can say, oh, they're having an orgasm.
Yeah, I love that. And this is something you emphasize a lot, that variation isn't pathology. You know, and we were talking about fantasies and fetishes the other day. We were talking about what we do on the show. And, you know, and so like in addiction, the question is, does your fantasy or your fetish, does it stop your life? You know, are you such an obsessive exerciser that you don't go to work in the morning because you're running 12 miles? And so can you talk a little bit about that, you know, the variations, the weird things people are into, and whether they're problematic or not?
Yeah, so there's a lot of variation in what turns people on and what turns people off. And I think of it sometimes like going to an ice cream shop, because there's so many different things, and some people are repulsed by some of the ideas of, you know, will you put what on your ice cream? There really is so many different things that different people like. And that also then maps onto all the variation in our bodies, right? All the variation in the way our genitals are and our psychologies are and our sex lives are. I'm a little bit careful with the term fetish. So I'm not a clinician at all, and I'm an evolutionary biologist by training. As you know, And but when I read the literature on fetishism, it depends on how you're using the word. In some domains, the term fetish strictly means it's something sexualized. So when you brought up, for instance, the case before of these people wearing diapers, it depends on whether or not wearing the diaper is something sexual. An adult could wear a diaper perhaps because they want to be treated like a baby. Well, it's unclear if that's necessarily sexualized. If they want to wear the diaper when they crawl into bed with someone and they want to have someone take the diaper off and then spank them and then masturbate them, well, then one can make an argument that the baby performance is tied to sexual desire and sexual activity. But on its own, you know, people do all sorts of things. And some of the activities, like someone maybe runs all the time and it makes them late to work and then they can't have a social relationship, when things that we like start to consume our life, that's when we get into the area, okay, this is probably a clinical problem, that this is taking over too much of your time. It's negatively affecting your work. It's negatively affecting your social relationships. And I think one thing I always try and encourage my students, and certainly when I give talks, I try and encourage is there's a heck of a lot of variation out there in the world. And we shouldn't be quick to pathologize it. We should not be quick to say that the different things people like mean that they're mentally ill or that they're crazy, or even that they're weird. They're just things that we don't necessarily like as individuals that some of us might not like. And unless it's really harmful, and that's what Dr. Kinsey's point, unless someone is doing something that's harmful to themselves and others, we really should avoid saying that that's a disease of some sort or crazy of some sort. It's just, you know, chocolate or vanilla.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I've learned something from you. So I could say it's an odd preference. And, you know, I always consider these weird things people write me about because I'm an advice columnist and I do love sex, dating, and relationships, that they would be some sex fetish. But I have one of these letters. I love that they're always from somewhere like Springfield, Illinois. They're from like the Midwest. They're not from New York, San Francisco. These people are like, oh, whatever. So the guy wrote me, I like to wear diapers and wet my diaper when I am around the house or running errands. I have not told my wife about this, and we've been together over a decade. Uh-oh. But my single days, I wore a diaper to bed every night and would wear one every day in the daytime, except when I was at work. So your point is so right that it doesn't seem like he's getting off. It seems like he's getting comfort from it. And I read about that also, you know, Masters and Johnson, they write about this in their book, Heterosexuality, about paraphilias. And, it's so interesting that people find these odd practices. They're a comfort source.
So we might imagine that someone who's, again, stepping a little bit outside my area, but someone who's wearing diapers, that it could have something to do with, an experience that happened in childhood, and wanting to reclaim that and feel, exactly, to feel that comfort. But the question is, for me, there's two questions. One, is it sexualized? Is it required? I mean, the true fetish is, you know, without that diaper, he can't get an erection, or has no interest in sex without, you know, the presence, the smell, the sight of diapers, is one issue. But then there's also the other issue. Even if it's not sexualized, one could imagine that an adult who wants to wear diapers for comfort, that this could have a negative impact on your romantic and/or sexual relationship. Certainly, in a college town, I imagine that if some of my students took someone home and they realized that they had were wearing a diaper that they had just wet, for not for a medical reason, just for fun, that might really change the outcome of your sex life.
This reminds me of the guy who once, he said, I have to show you something. He opened a closet. Now, if there had been bodies in there, I would have felt better. There were like 1,000 teddy bears. This is a grown man, and I was so horrified. I mean, it's like you unzip your skin, you run away screaming. And this guy with the diapers, I said, you know, I'm guessing the average woman is going to be appalled by this, you know. And people do this. They marry, and they have this like, okay, I can't stop this, and they don't bother to tell the person. And that's really horrible and unfair if you have some kind of thing that's not like, oh, well, I eat vanilla ice cream with sprinkles sometimes, but it's, you know, I like to pee in my diaper and sit in it all day at work.
Yeah, and that's this person who wrote to you. Sort of, I, what I'm thinking in this group, like, well, if you want to wear a diaper, okay, good for you to wear a diaper. But the fact that he's been hiding it from his wife for so long, that concerns me about what that could mean about their relationship. What's the effect of hiding something from your spouse for so long, something that maybe you're scared of, you're ashamed of, you're worried of? You know, for me, I look at relationships and the power of romantic relationships, the power of romantic love. And it's so intense and so central to the human condition. When we try and lie in those relationships or hide, of course it's okay for people to have private things that they don't want to share with others. But when your partner becomes someone that you're not wanting to share that with, what's the effect on your relationship? But also what's the effect on this poor guy's psyche? He's hiding something from his wife for so long. What kind of way is that to live?
Well, and if she finds out, say he's in an accident, but I think people make this unfair trade-off. They're basically stealing from a person in a way by being dishonest. They're making this trade-off that, okay, well, in order to be in a relationship, I'm not going to chance telling you this because our relationship might break up. Because, you know, I mean, for me, you know, there are all these men who wear the women's clothing and are their girlfriends or wives. Some of them are understanding. I'm not understanding about that. If I came home, sorry, Greg, who's my producer, if I came home and he was wearing my bra, I would, you know, still be his friend and everything. But that's just not something, that Rubicon is not one I can cross. And I think that there are the people who have these weirdnesses, you know, not pathologizing, but they're odd. You know, there are things that people can't deal with, the same way vegetarians maybe or vegans can't put up with somebody who eats brie.
I mean, after that, there's a part of me, as much as I love you, Amy, there's a part of me that I really hope that Greg puts on one of your dresses so when the show ends, you have a little surprise.
Greg is
but I think that. Sorry, Greg. Just so all the listeners know, Greg doesn't usually do this. But
he's sending me a Skype. Move on. He says, move on fast. Sorry.
but there is this idea, and again, I think that listen, if there's an heterosexual man who wants to wear a dress. Okay, that's fine. We know that could take, you know, when we think about the gender role and the gender is performance and how we perform our masculinity and we perform our femininity, right? So my faculty appointment, I'm in a gender studies unit department. And in gender studies, you know, we ask questions about the performance of masculinity and femininity and how that can be separate from the biology of a biological male or a biological female. But if a biological male wants to wear a dress sometimes, my concern is, are you having those conversations with your partner so that you can have an open and honest and healthy relationship? When people feel that they have to hide stuff, that's where I get a little bit concerned. And there's some evidence, right? There's data to support that when couples are hiding things from each other, it can be negative for the relationship. Like if when couples are hiding sexual dissatisfaction from each other, that could be a real problem in relationships.
Right. But I think the problem is that the relationship probably wouldn't have gotten off the ground if they had been honest in the first place. And I do want to add just that there is a way. I think that Englishmen all want to wear a dress, but they solve this by, if you go to a costume party and there are men there who are British, they will all be dressed as women. It's really odd. So there are ways to sort of occasionally vacation in, you know, the better dress section. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Kinsey Institute researcher and evolutionary biologist Dr. Justin Garcia. He is co-author with Dr. Peter Gray of Evolution and Human Sexual Behavior. So I want to talk about an area of your research, which is hookups. And all these pundits say, oh, my God, it's the end of relationships. And what I always say is, look, you know, people, they do this in college. And when they're done, when they feel a need for a relationship, they'll get into one. And don't worry about it. So what's your take on it?
So this is really at the heart of an area we've been publishing on for a few years, and hookup behavior. And we're framing it now in terms of hookup culture. I think it's more than just the behavior. It's thinking about the social and psychological and cultural things going on around it. But I don't think hookup culture is the sort of demise of America's morality. And in fact, I don't really think it's all that much of a problem. So in one of our recent studies, we looked at condom use and hookups and relationships, and gay condom use is relatively high. Not 100%, unfortunately, but relatively high. For many college students, they're sort of trying to weigh the risk. And on average, in a lot of our data, on average, men and women are happy with their hookup experiences. They're generally glad that they did it. It's a, what we call affect, positive affect. So generally happy they did it, glad they experienced it. Now, there are some negative consequences that do come out of some hookups. So particularly for women, a lot feel that there's stigma surrounding, you know, if they tell people that they hooked up. There's a lot of concern of how it affects one's reputation. There can be sexually transmitted infections. There can be an unintended pregnancy. What concerns me a bit more is what's going on in this relationship with sexual assault and sexual coercion. And we can talk about that in a minute because I think that's really important. And we need to keep in mind that even when we talk about the fun stuff, there's other things going on. But insofar as hookups is a real problem and it's the end of dating, well, that's a different issue. And I think a lot of the pundits to date have confused it. We've seen a decline in traditional dating culture, at least among college students and sort of among youth. And that's the idea of, you know, the 1920s, a young guy might go to a young woman's home, court her at her home in front of her parents, simultaneously courting her parents, eventually be allowed to take her outside of the home. And then we see as the generations move forward, well, then there's cars and there's dating activities and you pick them up and you go out on a date with them. And what's happened now, at least on most college campuses that have been studied, ranging from Ivy Leagues to community colleges, East Coast to West Coast, there's more of an engagement of, well, let's go to a party. Maybe we make out on the dance floor. Maybe we go home together. Maybe I wake up next to you and roll over and say, hey, you want to go to lunch? And that's your first date.
Right.
And we're seeing that dating is happening not as it did traditionally happen, that dating was courtship, that dating was a way to get to know people and to start relationships with them and then become sexual with them. That sexual activity is happening earlier on. And that sometimes sexual activity leads to relationships. One of my favorite studies we did, Chris Reiber and I did in 2008, was a study where we looked at a big group of college students, a little over 500 college students at Binghamton University in New York, and we said, well, how many of you are, what are the reasons you're hooking up? And about 90% said for physical gratification, for sex, for pleasure. Which is interesting, right? What we would expect, although some people would probably expect it to be 100%. No, it was only around 90%. But then we asked, well, tell us all the other reasons. And 50% of men and women, no gender difference, 50% of men and women said, I'm having an uncommitted sexual encounter, a hookup, for emotional gratification. And another 50% of men and women, no gender difference, said, I'm hooking up because I'm looking to start a romantic relationship. So that seems so counterintuitive on first, right? You're saying, well, you're going to meet someone who you don't really, you know, you're going to have oral sex maybe with someone who you don't really know that well because you're looking for love. It doesn't seem to make sense at first. But when you're in a context that there is not a dating culture, well, how do you start relationships? And it's engaging in this hookup behavior, these hookup activities, that people can be drawn to each other in the physical sense and then perhaps initiate romantic relationships. Now, that's not true. Dating hasn't died in America, but it's just among this particular age demographic. Among college students, there's not necessarily a vibrant dating culture to court. Most people who are in relationships, it's not really via what many of us might think of in terms of traditional dating.
And how successful is this, the hooking up to get into a relationship with someone? Do you have any data on that or anybody else?
We do, actually. No, we haven't published it yet, but we have some good data that suggests that of those people who hook up, about 1 in 3 have had a hookup turn into a relationship. So I wouldn't suggest, I'm not recommending that people who are looking for love go have 3 hookups and one of them will be a relationship.
Right.
But it is suggesting that these are turning into relationships. But a great study by a group in Virginia, they some data that just came out, and in their sample, the average college student had 2 hookups for every first date. So really, even when you think about the fact, you know, and when we look at the numbers, a whole bunch of students are only having 1 or 2 hookups. It's not like they're having, asking random sex every weekend for the entire duration of college. Although even if they are, I'm still not convinced that's necessarily a problem. When I look at problems, I look at, okay, is there potential for disease? Is there potential for negative psychological consequences? That's how I define a problem, not sort of moral panic about sex. But the best data is suggesting that some are turning into relationships.
That's very, very interesting. Yeah, and I agree with you on, is it disrupting your life psychologically? You know, are you not going to class? Do you have some kind of weird bug? I think that's very wise. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Kinsey Institute researcher and evolutionary biologist, Dr. Justin Garcia. He is co-author with Dr. Peter Gray of a very smart new book, Evolution and Human Sexual Behavior. Now, we were talking about oral sex. You mentioned oral sex, and you told me something very interesting, that there's a hierarchical reordering of oral sex. You know, that now it happens, that's researchers speak, and then real person speak, is now it happens more often before intercourse than it used to. And you said something very funny. You said, I don't want to go so far as to call it the new handshake. So give us a story on oral sex today.
Yeah, right. Think about how many people wash their hands obsessively. Maybe we should see people washing their genitals obsessively. But... So exactly, that's so the technical lingo is the hierarchical reordering of oral sex. And what that means is that a few generations ago, some of us might, if you're feeling particularly courageous for the barbecue this weekend, ask some of your parents or elders about oral sex in their lives. and what we see is that for a lot of particularly older Americans, oral sex is more viewed as, whether it be fellatio or cunnilingus, both performing on men or women, oral sex happened later in a relationship. It often happened after you had intercourse with a partner. But today we're seeing it much more happen before intercourse. But it almost is a little bit more casual. We see fairly high rates of oral. We see higher rates of oral sex than penetrative vaginal intercourse and hookups, for instance. It's taken on a different role. But it's interesting because it also, for some, particularly oral sex among women, cunnilingus, is often associated with, sometimes we can imagine that vaginal intercourse is less personal than having someone so close to your genitals, with the face in your genitals. Part of the oral sex patterns are tied to people's individual attitudes and how their own attitudes about their body and their own body esteem. And their own affect their oral sex behavior. So on average, we're seeing that men are receiving oral sex slightly more than women are receiving oral sex, also that men achieve orgasm from oral sex. But part of that has to do with sort of partner competency. But oral sex is really taking on a new role. So one of the things we're interested in hookup culture is, how does that affect hookup, the fact that we've seen we're seeing higher rates of anal sex in America, particularly among heterosexuals, and we're seeing oral sex happening earlier on. Well, that's got to affect these seemingly uncommitted sexual encounters, but the way that they are is still unclear. It's just sort of all these things happening in these changing sexual scripts in America today.
Yeah. Oh, Justin, are you still there? Did we lose you?
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Oh, no, you're still – okay, good.
Here,
talk a little bit more into your phone because it's warbling a little bit. So, okay, we're going to move from the front end to the back end. You say that there are increasing rates of anal sex in youth. So what I want to know is, how did something that was pretty much unheard of when I was a teenager become like, oh, no problem, borrow dad's car, let's, try some anal with teens, for example?
Yeah, so interesting way to put it. For many people, it's an experimentation. So many couples, higher rates, this is work, Debbie Herbenick, a colleague of mine here at Indiana University, has done some of this work and shown that higher rates of anal sex, it doesn't mean that necessarily men and women are engaging in it all the time, but they're experimenting with it, they're trying it. There's also a non-negligible number of particularly youth who say, I want to save my virginity, and I'm not going to have penetrative vaginal sex, so I'll have penetrative anal sex.
I love
Yeah, so I mean, yes, it's true. You can't get pregnant from anal, so it's a way to knock it, but you can certainly still get all the sexually transmitted infections, and it's still a penetrative sexual behavior. But for many people, PVI, penetrative vaginal intercourse, is sort of given that special place and waiting for a special time or a special person. So other behaviors are explored. There's also some evidence, although it's unclear what the national numbers are, but at least if you look at sort of media representation, that there's more thinking and more talking about the anus and the sphincter as being involved in sexual pleasure. And that includes for both men and women, whether it might include mouth-to-anal stimulation or finger stimulation of the anus during oral sex or during intercourse. And it's on both men and women, both heterosexual and homosexual.
So now, is this a reflection of porn's effect on kids? I mean, there are all these people that are, you know, they're hysterical about porn. Porn is ruining kids and ruining sex lives. And where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I think this is really important. And this is something that's so hotly debated. I'm on a listserv with several hundred sex researchers, and we all sort of email each other about new things and research. And this gets issues about pornography get so heated. The debates get so heated. We don't know. We don't really understand the way that pornography has changing culture. People often jump up and say, well, pornography leads to addiction. There is a little bit of evidence that excessive porn use might be having, is a problem in some people's lives, that it might have a problem in terms of them being able to, so some men, for instance, might watch so much porn that they can't get an erection unless there's porn on. So you might be with your partner getting ready to have sex, you've got to go put a porn on so you can get an erection to perform. So there is cases like that, but it's really unclear in terms of being a large-scale problem that's facing America. And it's unclear the effect of pornography on the data is really unclear about the effect of pornography on our own sex lives. On the one hand, I do think that it can be troublesome. What bothers me are the type of pornography that degrade women, for instance, as a gender studies scholar. That really bothers me. But on the other hand, I think that there are probably some people who are getting their sex ed, sadly as that is, from porn. The current state of affairs in America is, despite the fact that 95% of Americans have sex before marriage, and most people are struggling with the role of sex and sexuality in their lives, not necessarily struggling in a bad way, but sort of integrating and enjoying. Despite those facts, we haven't, as a country, really stood up and said, we need a really solid, decent sexual education program to take sex seriously. Some people are turning to pornography for their information, and that could be a little bit of a problem, particularly when there's scenes like that are violent or degrade women. So one of the things that has changed is porn has become much more violent in the last few years. A documentary recently by Michael Kimmel demonstrated that a lot of this porn has become really violent. And that I worry a little bit about. But one of the things that people have thought that porn has done is changed the way that we perceive the body. And you and I were also talking about, for instance, like pubic hair removal. And a few places in the world do people remove their pubic hair as a sign of sexual maturity. There is one society I know of in South America where the girls go through puberty, their males pluck the hairs from their vulva as they come out, but it's ritualized. But in the U.S., for instance, we see fairly high rates of both men and women, but particularly women, removing at least a portion or all of the hair from their genitals. Some people have said, well, then it makes it look like a pubescent. You know, is it because men want to be with these girls, women who look like girls? I don't know if I buy that argument. I mean, if you're having sex with a 40-year-old woman who has no pubic hair, her genitals are still tied to the body of a 40-year-old woman. I don't think it, and the genitals look like those. I don't think it necessarily makes it look prepubescent, but it changes a whole lot. The fact that when the vulva and the genital organs become more visually and easier to see, ranging from there's all this bejazzling and all these different things that can happen to modify the genitals.
Yeah, and actually, well, see, the thing is, I mean, yes, there is really some sick porn out there. And there's, I love the internet rule 34. If it exists, there's porn of it. I even saw, you know, a woman, it was on crack.com, so who knows. And I couldn't find the shot, but a woman sucking off Mr. Peanut, you know, giant Mr. Peanut. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, there's like Smurf porn. It's insane. But I tend to think that people are smarter than we give them credit for. And also you as an evolutionary psychologist and I have heard the research presented on how men like to be the ravagers and women like to be ravaged, which isn't to say that, you know, rape is good or anything like that. But so those things, you know, that's part of it. You know, women are into that. But of course, as a woman, you're picturing yourself being ravaged by Clive Owen, not a drug addict with a rusty knife in an alley. So, you know, and that's what I think people know. And also you made the point too about amateur porn, that there's more amateur porn now than ever.
Oh, yeah, this is, I mean, so you can go on websites like Pornhub and XTube, there are all these websites that there's amateur pornography. People film their own porn, they send it in. Some of them are clips of professional porn. So actually the pornography industry has changed a lot in the last few years. And the numbers really haven't been released, but from what I've heard, there's some suggestion that it's less by look as a $13 billion industry, but it's still a big profitable industry. But those numbers are going down because so much you can get of just people filming themselves and sending it in. And that's really interesting. It's sort of, well, why do people want to make these homemade porn and then have others watch it? I think there's a few reasons. So as you know, Peter Gray and I and Michelle Escasa did a study a few years ago in a sex club in Las Vegas. And when I was there, I noticed that there were a few different types of people who come, and some were people who their relationship was struggling and they were trying to save it. And I'm sure, Amy, you've got some thoughts on people who have a failing relationship and go to a sex club and try to fix it up.
Yeah.
And there are others who were there really for the eroticism and having other people watch them, so the sort of voyeurism. And I wonder how much of that is at play with this sort of amateur porn, that the idea that other people are getting off watching you, other people are aroused by your sex life.
Yeah, I do agree with you on that. I think that's a big part of it. And that is, people write to me a lot about threesomes, and I think that is a big part of a lot of people's threesomes, more than people realize, that it's really not about that third person always being involved, that it's about that third person watching, and they get turned on by that. And sometimes the third person actually is the another person in the relationship watches two people have sex and they like feeling sort of degraded. But, you know, as long as it isn't a problem, as long as it enhances your relationship, people, as you were saying, make all sorts of judgment on that stuff. But, hey, you know, if it makes you happy, you know, who are we to argue?
Yeah, I mean, it's And in that case, you might be making three people happy.
Exactly. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Kinsey Institute researcher and evolutionary biologist, Dr. Justin Garcia. His new book is Evolution and Human Sexual Behavior, co-authored with Dr. Peter Gray. And so I wanted to talk to you about romantic baby talk, because I have these women on. They are not researchers, but they wrote a book called Don't Call Him Honey, and I forget the subtitle, but basically saying, I agree with them on almost all of the book, except for this notion that by calling somebody honey, that you kill your sexual relationship. And I agree with them, you don't call him schmoopy or something like that. Call a man schmoopy, that's sort of horrifying. But you actually did some research on this romantic baby talk.
Yeah, two friends of mine are going to kill me if they hear this. When I was in graduate school, I lived with a couple, two very good friends, and they used to talk in baby talk. They know that they were the inspiration for this study. So, and I thought it was so interesting. And I thought to myself, well, why do you talk to someone like a baby that you have sex with? Why do you infantilize someone that you're sexually involved with? And I remember one day they were doing it, and I grabbed my phone, and I called my colleague, Rose Dokel Chang, who you know. And Rose is specialized in things like mother ease and baby talk, between mothers and children, and the impact of babble and baby talk on child development. And so I call Rose, Rose, why do you think two people who are in a relationship talk to each other like babies? She goes, I don't know. And I go, do you think this is adaptive? Has there been any work on it? And she goes, I don't know. No, I don't think so. I don't think there's been anything. And then she goes, I have a question for you. And I go, what? And she goes, why are you whispering? And I go, oh, they're in the other room. And I was so, it was really interesting about how this sort of like, oh, can I get you ice cream? You want ice cream? I'll get you a spoon. You don't want the spoon. You want that spoon? I'll get you the spoon.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, yeah, I know. So we did a study on what we called lovery. So when romantic partners use this sort of baby talk. And I think part of it is something that's cute and something that's special and unique. Often couples struggle with trying to find something that's special to them, that's unique for them, really kind of, and it's a way to sort of talk in a special and cute way, in a way that you wouldn't do in public with others. I thought a lot of it was about conflict resolution early on, and we didn't actually find great evidence in the study that we did, but I still think that there might be something going on where some couples are doing it to sort of diffuse the fight, right, where something happens that could potentially become an argument, but let's sort of be playful about it and diffuse it and talk like babies and then have sex. Still really interesting to me and seems unusual to me, but turns out that about 2/3 of couples say that they do it occasionally with their romantic partner.
Yeah, so I don't think it's a problem unless you call them something really embarrassing. So now you have Match.com gives you this huge data set. You and Helen Fisher work with this, and so I want to ask you a question as somebody who sees all the data from a huge internet dating site. How can people make internet dating work better for themselves?
Oh, this is great. And Helen and I we've been working with Match.com since 2010. A fantastic organization to work with, really supports science, and trying to understand how these matching processes are happening. And what we've done is, let me answer your question first. And that's really how can we enrich people's dating lives and using online dating? We all remember when online dating happened and people used to have to say, well, there's not much stigma with it anymore. And you only have to say that if there really is still a little bit of stigma with it. But those days really are gone. I mean, we're seeing, about 1 in 3 people have tried internet dating at least once. And our national representative data set, I think this is wonderful, over 20% of people met their last partner through an online dating site. Close to 30% through the internet in general, but a little over 20% through an online dating site. And among gays and lesbians, it's closer to 50% who have met their most recent partner on an online dating site, among singles in their previous dating relationship. So really, I mean, people are turning to certain groups of sexual minorities are really benefiting from online dating. I think the best advice we can give is be honest. People are always going to try and put their best foot forward. But be honest, and if you're looking for something, this is really a venue to help people find what they're looking for. A note of caution, though.
Wait, I want to stop you. What do you mean? Wait, Justin. What do you mean by be honest? Because, you know, you and I have both seen all these psych studies that say, well, women are looking for men of, you know, that have earned a good living and drive a nice car and then want beautiful women. And then they find out that they go on a date and someone's gained 300 pounds. So what does be honest mean?
Yeah, I think if you're, if you're, 90 pounds and you say you're 180, and that's a lie. but the best evidence that what we've seen so far is that doesn't happen quite that often. It's more that people put a picture that's maybe a few years old or when they were 10 pounds lighter or when they were 10. And I don't know if I would call that deception. A lot of people go, people lie on these sites. I don't think that's lying. I think that's people honestly trying to put their best foot forward, trying to represent themselves in the best light, because this is a dating game in many ways. Some of it can also be people's own delusions of how we all identify ourselves. I think we all have our, when push comes to shove and we have to describe ourselves, sometimes others could describe us quite differently than we think of describing ourselves. So some of it could actually be quite innocent. But by and large, most people are honest because they're looking to have fun and meet new people. And one of the things I think is great about online dating, when I moved to Bloomington, I started doing online dating myself. I hadn't done it before. It's a total dream. It's a lot of fun. But really, you don't go on an online dating site to find your immediate spouse. You want an online dating site to start dating, to meeting new people. And one of those might turn into a love relationship, someone who you love and you adore and you marry. Absolutely. But it's about meeting new people, dating new people, and hopefully, if it's what you want, that can turn into something more. But actually, we should also know there's a lot of variation. So, for instance, like AshleyMadison.com, websites about people who are looking at affairs. And then there's dating sites in other countries, like Shadi.com is an Indian, primarily Indian online dating site. And
right.
The dating
yeah.
tends to be a little bit more about finding someone, it's more focused on, you know, the nuts and bolts of what do you want to get married, do you want, there's a lot of cultural variation in online dating too.
Yeah, and you pointed out too, as I feel, that it's very important, one thing that's really essential is to see somebody, meet them, smell them right away. People make a big mistake by prolonging the process where they're still online. And I think it should be called online meeting, and that you need to get on a date right away. And our last comment, because we are out of time, I wanted you just to talk about, you mentioned Robert Sternberg's love stories and how we end up making these projections about who somebody is when we just talk to them, you know, for weeks and weeks and weeks online or via email or on Skype instead of meeting.
Yeah, I love the concept of love stories. And it's that we all, exactly, we have these images in our head of the white picket fence and how many kids we want, or maybe it's a blue house, a red house. And often we try and make those stories become a reality. And on the one hand, that's great. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people who I think meet someone who could be perfect or are perfect in many ways or are great for them. But they might say, well, the person in my love story was actually over 6 foot tall. Or, well, the person in my love story, well, she actually had, you know, brown hair. And then they don't actually go through with getting to know someone and possibly having a wonderful relationship because they're so focused on the story that they have in their head. So on the one hand, it's great to try and help make them a reality and using technology to make our love stories true. But on the other hand, I think that we don't want to discount all the magic of real life romance because we're in our head.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, accepting the unexpected. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. Justin, thank you so much. My guest tonight is Kinsey Institute researcher and evolutionary biologist, Dr. Justin Garcia, his book, Evolution and Human Sexual Behavior. Thanks again. You were great.
Thanks, Amy.
From the kids' table to the office party table, the game day table to the Thanksgiving table, smart